Janet and Tam Lim, an in-person classroom discussion, part two, 45 minutes.
And so what do we see with young women? I mean, at a certain age, they defy their parents and go off and find, you know, erotically interesting men, you know, motorcyclists or musicians or people with tattoos or, you know, somebody that their daddy wouldn't approve of. And they have sex and they explore that whole realm of being, which is in opposition to respectable, well-educated people with life insurance.
I heard two ladies talking the other day, and they were saying daughters are the worst. When you have daughters, that's the worst.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You know, it's like the old joke, well, in the past, you know, women had to get up and get married. Now the women have the joke is, why should I buy the whole pig if all I want is a little sausage? So, but it's kind of profound. I mean, it's funny, but you know, they can take the masculine on their own terms. They don't have to be committed to the pig, right?
I didn't catch that. Could you repeat that?
Why should I buy the whole pig if I just wanted a little sausage?
Wasn't the word cake in there somewhere?
Cake. Maybe if you want the bun.
But see, it's about individuation. It's about not just being a father's daughter, not just growing up within the realm of your father's masculine authority, but claiming, for a woman to claim her own unique individual relationship to the masculine in defiance of dad. So she's not just going to be a good girl. She's going to find her own way. And this is why children are so difficult for their parents to deal with, because as they seek independence, because part of the growing up process is defying whatever it is their parents want. The kids have to defy it. So they have to drive you nuts in order to get free. And, you know, that's why, you know, you see plenty of middle-class, well-educated young women, at least for a time, wanting to have an alliance with somebody who their parents really wouldn't approve of and couldn't accept. You know, maybe after a while I'll go back and choose somebody more like their parents as a partner. But for a while, they need to rebel and scare the hell out of the parents, you know.
Yeah. Ask a question more generally in terms of individuation. Is that, it's just my lack of knowledge, but is that a process throughout the lifespan of human development, or is it more like around these sort of milestones of
sexuality and growth? It's a good question. You can think of it as in the stages of childhood and adolescence. You can think of it that way, because those kind of issues come up all through that time. But you can also think of it as a later series of developments, because having grown into adulthood, you may then have to go through a whole process of encountering the green man, you know? It might be a midlife experience of encountering the green man and delving into it. Supposing you did grow up respectable and well-educated and, you know, middle class, and you didn't defy your parents, then maybe in middle life you have to go through some drastic upheaval. Or maybe you did defy your parents and then you have to do it all over again, you know? These things are cyclical. So, both end.
And is that idea of individuation unique to Jung, or is that just
Jung wrote a lot about it, but if you, for example, Winnicott talks about something related to this. I mean, he tends to describe it in childhood. But Jung wrote a lot about it as an adult experience. But Jung's description and Winnicott's descriptions are interesting because they overlap a lot, even though the two men are talking about different phases of life.
And Maslow's self-actualization being part of it too?
Yeah. Yeah. But they're different ways of conceiving of it, but of a similar kind of phenomenon.
What about if this is like a, you're saying these aren't real people, it's not necessarily a little girl going out in the world. But let's say within my psyche, it's, let's say, kind of masculine dominated, I find it a little bit tougher to be on the sensitive side. So could this be self-talk also, allowing the feminine to find its own way in partial defiance of the masculine?
Yes. So as men go through life, their feminine needs to go through processes of development in order to become more richly worked out. So the men go through these kind of processes speak to men in terms of the evolution of their feminine, just as the evolution of the masculine speaks not only to men but also to women as they cultivate their own phallic side, you know, as they go through. Yes.
So in the case of Anne's friend by the dream, the relationship to the feminine is just this kind of torrent of water that's really not under control at all. So it's like almost bringing that force of water into some manageable, you know, but getting the chamber for it or a pipe or being able to control that force of nature and not just let it go all over the business world. Being in a business environment and being able to embrace the feminine but in a more productive capacity.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah, that's yes. If she could, if she could control the flow, if she could manage the flow of her feelings,
feminize the flow, right?
Yeah, no.
Right, you could say that. Yeah.
So how do you do that? What are some of the ways of? Because, you know, I kind of, like, I have a definite feminine nature, but it's not really one that I'm able to manage. It just comes out as extreme sensitivity. So what are some of the things you think about when you're trying to canalize that feminine energy into a reasonable fashion?
Well, I think, one way to think about it is it has to do with relationships. So because it's in relationships that the subtleties of emotional life get educated. So for men, it's about learning to be more in more vulnerable ways involved in personal relationships and sharing feelings and expressing feelings and listening to the other person's feelings and responding to the other person's feelings,
mm-hmm.
you know, learning to be more engaged in the feminine activities of talking and listening and empathizing and feeling, and, you know, it's the process of, you know, and one does that in therapy, one does that in family, one does that in marriage. You know, you were talking about marriage being difficult, and that whole commitment to relate for better and for worse through difficulties, you know, in hard times, that's a commitment which enables men to grow because they're bound into relationship. And they have to listen. They can't just ignore their partner. They have to listen. They have to struggle to understand.
Yeah, like in the relationship, I have a visceral need to act or yell or do whatever, and just, I guess, pulling that back and more of the nurturing kind of
trying to Yeah, and trying to listen. Men are not necessarily so good at listening. You know, oftentimes you go to a restaurant and you hear the guy talking and talking and talking and talking and talking and talking,
yeah,
and the girl is just sitting there kind of looking a little glazed, listening. And you know that's not going very well between those two people. The guy's talking too much. And oftentimes it's the guy talking, I have to say. It can be the other way too. But
so but for Valentine's Day. The rose is still on.
That's the nice flag.
I just read an interesting line in Jung. He said that people have this fantasy that they're going to fall in love and get married and then live happily ever after. And then he said, that's exactly wrong. That's the point where problems really start to begin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why, it's one reason, psychological reason why committed relationships are so important. Because if you're really committed to working something out as best you can, doesn't always work, but trying, then you get plunged into all those tangles which bring up more primitive feelings, and you have a chance to work on those primitive feelings.
Yeah.
You know, so the chance to heal some of those injuries, and it's only in a really strong commitment that's possible.
Because it's safe, or because you know they're gonna show up again.
Yeah,
what makes it be a safe place to do it.
Well, it's the commitment, yeah, to be there for each other through in sickness and in health, through for better or for worse. In other words, you have to stick it out even when it feels like shit, you know, and you hate the other person and you can't stand them and they feel like, why on earth did I ever think I was attracted to you, and why on earth would I want to be married to you? You know, everything about you is wrong. You're not giving me anything that I want. It's total frustration. For God's sake, what was I thinking? You know, obviously I should have married somebody else. It's only if you can keep on slogging in the tough times that you begin to struggle with your own difficulties, mm-hmm. You know, because you project it all onto your partner. It's all your partner's fault. You know, if only I'd married somebody else, I wouldn't be having these problems. You don't realize that you brought these problems, at least 50% of the problem you brought with you. So it's about sticking it out in the hard times. That's what that's the psychological dimension of for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's being willing to go through the worse.
And in this thing, that's what they turned into an asp and a hot lead and that kind of stuff. The two words that strike me, and I'm no expert, but one is commitment and the other is faith.
And the other is what?
Faith.
Faith, okay,
faith.
Yeah,
faith. And commitment.
Yeah, okay.
Almost
yeah.
In equal measure.
Yeah.
You know, the commitment that, you know, when she turns into molten lead,
yeah.
And she will, she does.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. And the faith that there is something greater beyond that.
Yeah.
Maybe yourself, I haven't met.
Yeah, and I don't mean to lay a trip on anybody that you should have stuck it out in that particular relationship, because not necessarily.
I already pulled the plug on that one, man. I was like, what was I supposed to do?
These are the
flip notes for the next one.
What I'm trying to say is that if a relationship works successfully, then the people can stick it out and work, and they can work on stuff, and something evolves. You know, and sometimes that's because you chose the right person and you can work stuff through, or sometimes it's because you have couples therapy and that helps you go to another level. You know, it's sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but at least it's a possibility.
And it seems like it's the willingness of both people to recognize that maybe they're both projecting, you know, and deal with those kinds of conflicts.
And to talk. It's the magic of talk. Talk is magic. If people are willing to sit down and talk about what the hell's going on, it gives them a chance to begin to tease out the thing. You know, so, and that's therapy, you know, talk is magic, because if you can tolerate the discomfort of talking about it, then you can begin to find other levels of meaning.
Even more powerful than talking, I think, is listening.
And listening, right, talking and listening, yeah.
Yeah, if we don't hears this all the time.
Yeah. So when I say talk,
it's a learning experience.
Yeah. So I mean, talking and listening.
Active listening.
Yeah. But see, that's this magical thing that human beings can do that no other animals can do. So when we start talking to each other and listening to each other, then we have this whole magical realm of meaning that we can explore, and we create meaning by talking, which is what we're doing here. You know, we're talking to each other.
Yeah, I heard a good statistic. I go into marriage counseling too. And, you know, my wife doesn't like any negative interactions. And they found out that you can actually, they were charting people, couples, and charting the negative versus positive interactions. And they found out that the negative to the positive to negative in couples who are going for divorce, it was 0.8 negative to 1 positive. Mm-hmm. So, but even in healthy couples that were lasting, there wasn't 1 negative for every 5 positives. And the spectrums in between.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere between. So in any case, there's a significant, even good relationships, there's a significant number of negative interactions. And what it described was that when the negative happens, you don't ratchet it up
mm-hmm.
beyond to a holistic level, and that you have the tools to repair.
Mm-hmm. To talk, to engage in some work. Yeah. Yeah, let's look some more at the dream at that story. So let's think about this idea that the Tamlin was once a mortal knight, and Janet asks him, "You must tell me, Tamlin, you must tell me, were you once a mortal knight of mortal hall did see?" And he says he was, but he fell off his horse and the fairy queen stole me away. So now, what's going on? What are we talking about here? What is this psychologically that a mortal knight could fall off his horse and be stolen by the fairy queen?
The blasphemy before and now.
Yeah.
He turns into this other magical Russian.
Yeah, so what kind of psychological dynamic is this?
Well, we have the king and the father, and then we have the fairy queen who is taking the mortal. You know, it's almost the reverse. There's some weird reversal going on there.
But we have a mortal knight, yes to what you're saying, we have a mortal knight who has fallen into the underworld, and now has coming out and talking words to this, to mortal Janet.
Mm-hmm.
So what has happened here to the underworld? What has been introduced to the underworld?
Mortal.
Male.
Mm-hmm. You already said, read your paper. So consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which paper are you talking about?
The one you referred to in the Egyptian mythology.
There's okay.
A consciousness in the unconscious.
Yes, right. So that consciousness has contributed the capacity to speak into the unconscious. So now the unconscious can talk, or this representative of the unconscious can now talk about his predicament. So can you think of a dream image that might portray this situation? Well, that's not a fair question. I have to give it to you. Sometimes in dreams you have a dream figure who's a photographer, who's taking pictures of the action. In other words, you have a figure in the unconscious who is observing what's going on in this unconscious drama and recording it using conscious technology.
Mm.
A camera is something devised by rationality.
Mm.
So we're examining the unconscious dynamics using rational thinking. So it's a bit like a scientist who gives up science and begins to listen to dreams and delve into the dream world. You know, it's like
you.
Yeah, it's like anybody who investigates.
You too.
It's like consciousness investigating and so we have the capacity to analyze what's going on.
And here there is, and she brings also the feminine aspect into this masculine being, right?
Right. And he needs her to pull the rider down. So he is stuck in this underworld position, and he can't evolve unless she asserts herself by selecting him and pulling him off his horse, and then holding him. So, what's going on here? What is she doing? Pursuing what you said.
She's making a commitment to. It seems like he's like an unconscious figure, and the unconscious by itself never really met. Well, I guess it manifests, but you need a conscious ego or a consciousness to bring it under observation and hold it there.
Yeah.
The rest of there.
Yes. So, how is she holding it? I mean, what energy is she providing to this situation?
She loves him.
Loving, yeah, and embracing,
protects him,
right, and holds him, right. So the feminine, the containing, the feminine capacity to contain, holds this primitive masculine potential.
And it's also a fight against the fairy queen. The woman has to fight against the witch. Right?
Yes.
I mean, fairy queen.
That's right.
So she's fighting not only encroachment of her father's domain, but the possibility that he might encroach on her private relationship, but also against the fairy queen,
yes,
the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so she sees.
Trying to destroy the knight, apparently. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Situation.
So what is she doing when she chooses the third rider and pulls him off his horse and then holds him and won't let him go even as he goes through all these alchemical changes? What kind of activity is she? Is a human activity? What's going on? What's she up to?
Like a mother?
It's not mothering.
She's saying commitment and faith, right?
Commitment
and faith.
And faith, yeah.
Embrace.
Sorry?
Embrace.
Embrace. It's an embrace. So we've moved from the archetypal situation where she's her father's daughter and he's in the grip of the fairy queen. We've moved into, I mean, it's still archetypal, but it's become more like a personal relationship. It's like a marriage, if you like, or it's an embrace. It's a relationship between the masculine and the feminine, where the feminine is holding the masculine in relationship. So the man and woman, male and female, are now tightly held in an embrace, which permits transformation.
No matter what.
Yeah. In spite of the difficulties. So it's the capacity of the feminine to embrace and to hold. You know, and this is played out in relationship where, you know, the guy maybe would like to be off playing football or doing his surfing or playing the horses or drinking with his buddies or sleeping around, and the girl holds him and binds him in relationship and says, no, you have to stay with me, we have to talk, we have to struggle together, we have to work on our relationship, you have to come see a therapist, you can't go surfing, you've got to spend some time at home with me, and we got to explore this. And you can't just go off and be this free, unrelated masculine being. You have to engage.
It's very person-free, though. He was caught by the fairy queen.
Okay, so what does that imply in our psychological experience? What is that?
Relationship that doesn't allow us to go.
Yeah, and what relationship do you think this might be for the guy?
The mother,
the mother, right?
The mother, the bowing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. the guy is really secretly still in the embrace of his mother. Isn't that so, you know? If you want to find a guy, first of all, check out what's his relationship with his mom.
Always.
Because it's liable to be a problem, so check it out. And, you know, and the girl is going to be in, to some degree in competition with the mom for the guy's attention.
But
right?
the mother is not necessarily the evil in the man's life. I mean, it could be the evil feminine could come from other sources.
Of course.
Other women.
Of course.
Or groups of women.
Of course.
Or something within the feminine psyche in that period.
Of course. Yeah, we're not literally saying that the mother is the source of evil.
But this is one that's not letting him go. I mean,
yeah.
She's
the problem
forcefully
has...
Forcefully restraining him.
Yeah, that's the issue. It's the forceful restraining, trying not to let him go, which all mothers struggle with this. Many mothers. It's a struggle for mothers to let their children go because they've been in this powerfully satisfying relationship. And so they have to go through a lot of hardship in order to let their children go. And there's always a conflict.
It's a frightening image because you see him on this horse,
uh-huh.
And it reminded me of the Earl Hunter.
Of the what?
Who rides the Sushbe, does not. You know what I'm talking about?
Not exactly.
Well, there's an image of the father riding with the son who's sick. And they're riding it through the night, and the sun is dying, and it's called the Arrow Clinic. And here you have the fellow riding this horse, or the horse is going headlong into hell with him.
Uh-huh.
And he tells her what to do to save him. It's a terrifying sort of image.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the Fairy Queen would have plucked out his heart and his eyes, mm-hmm. and turn them to stone. So this is dangerous stuff here. But if we think about it in terms of individuation, what is it implying? You know, if I've already said what it implies in terms of a young man and a young woman struggle with each other. But if we think about it in terms of later individuation processes,
if you don't do it, that's what will happen to you.
Okay. But what is it later in life? What is the struggle? Well, it's the struggle with the unconscious. You know, if you want to develop consciousness, you will have to struggle with the unconscious, which tries to... The unconscious has a very ambivalent response to the development of consciousness. You know, the unconscious gives you the dream, and then you have to struggle to interpret it, and the unconscious will try to trick you into not interpreting it. Because what happens, the unconscious gives you a dream, you wake up, and then you forget it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the unconscious gave it to you, but then the unconscious grabs it back again if you don't work hard to remember it. So if you don't have a book beside your bed, and if you don't write it down quickly, the unconscious will take it back.
Mm-hmm.
So the unconscious is always ambivalent, and you have to relate to it correctly in order to steal from it the knowledge which it offers you. So how you relate to the unconscious determines whether or not you will be successful in stealing from it the knowledge which it offers. And if you don't have the right question ready when the Grail question is asked, if you don't have the question ready, you will the time will pass and you won't be able to get what you need from it. So this is the eternal struggle here. Which is to say that the psyche is conservative and it doesn't really easily permit change. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to ask if you could say more about if the consciousness isn't ready, it doesn't have the question. I don't understand that.
Well, when the psyche offers experiences, like supposing life has given you, you've been fired, for example, then that's an opportunity to learn something. Maybe there's some psychological growth is possible here. For some reason, your boss turned on you and fired you. Now you can you can not ask the question and say, well, it was his problem, he shouldn't have fired me, and I'm just going to go about my merry way. Or you can ask the question, well, why did that happen? What was going on? What was I doing? You know, what was the unconscious process here? You can analyze it. That would be to ask the question. Or you have a dream, and the dream frightens you. It's a nightmare. And you can say, well, I know what that means. That means that I wasn't supposed to do this, that, and the other thing. In other words, you've imposed your conscious interpretation without really examining the dream. So you haven't asked the right question, and you won't learn the lesson that was being offered to you.
But it's interesting, the question, meaning, does that mean when you say you pass the moment? And how final is this? I mean, meaning it sounds pretty final, like if someone misses these opportunities, at what point in life, is it too late?
Yeah, it is not to say literally in a lifetime you can't go back and do it again.
Maybe
but there are moments, I suppose. There are crossroad moments.
Right.
But then you have another chance later, hopefully.
And also, I think something you said in the first class, or maybe I don't know when, but this idea that if you're not paying attention, the unconscious will remind you again. I mean, it comes, I think that's been my experience.
It comes back.
Something will come back.
Yes.
With a different kind of inflection or force.
Yes, yes.
But I guess there is something about that at a certain point in time, you're too old or too whatever to try to, I mean, I'm wondering, there's a moment where that lack of self, of consciousness and of going into those questions and asking the right questions, and then
people make fateful decisions. I mean, it's not all, we're not all in a situation where we have repeated opportunities to try again and learn some more. People make fateful decisions. You know, you make choices which have, you know, implications for decades from there. So there are fateful moments. It's not forever. You know, there'll probably be another chance to look at it another way. But maybe in a different decade of your life, the re-examination will have a different potential. You know, so you know maybe you didn't choose the partner in your 20s whom you could have chosen, and it could have led in a very fertile and fascinating direction, but you didn't choose that partner. So you married safely. Maybe you married somebody who was not that potential. And so your relationship went off in another direction. And then in your 50s or your 60s, you know, you realize that there's something you haven't done yet. You have to explore it in another way. You know, your life takes a different course. And it's not to say there's a right way and a wrong way, but it makes a difference. You know, what you choose makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all hunky-dory, you know. You pay a price.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the kind of the philosophy of astrology with these transits and progressions. But, you know, and there's no hard fixed thing, but I think life's exactly like Groundhog Day. And there's an endless series of opportunities to always, you know, be willing to quit your job or be willing to... There is volition. It's not just fate, you know, an astrologer can tell you if you're going to be fired or married. There's a self ability to self-determine this will,
mm-hmm.
that when you recognize that you are going to Groundhog's Days, I think there's an endless life. Warren Buffett once said that life pitches you an endless series of pitches, and
mm-hmm.
it's up to you which one you swing at.
Mm-hmm.
And I think each day you get a lot of different pitches.
Yeah, the more... See, it's more about attitude. The more open you are to the messages that are coming to you, the more chances you have to learn from them. So it's about being open to the unconscious, being willing to work with the unconscious when it speaks to you, and learning. And, you know, what Jung meant by individuation was really cultivating an attitude of listening and relating to the unconscious on an ongoing basis. So that as you get messages, you try to, at least some of the time, try to listen and try to work with them. I think that's... So what do you think about this whole sequence of transformations. And a snake, a lion, a red hot bar of iron, burning lead, and then a naked knight. What's that all about?
Well, that's the best one at the end there. I'd have to pick that one.
It's reading on shape-shifting and the symbols that it was in the book that it was talking about, that it's showing different aspects of the psyche,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily progressive sort of development, but just more but that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, different aspects. And all very potent and vital aspects. You know, the snake, a very potent phallic symbol that goes between layers and communicates. It's like Mercurius communicates between layers. The lion, the passion and instinctual intensity, devouring potential of the lion, and courage and bravery. The red hot iron, the heat, and the strength of iron and the power of iron and the burning lead. I don't know what that would
be. It feels very alchemical.
Yeah. All the different parts of the phallic male energy that has to be integrated, or that can be integrated.
It ends up with the child, the defenseless elemental child.
He's not a child. No, be careful.
The babe.
No, he's not a babe. He's naked.
Naked.
He's not a child. He's a knight. He's a man. He's a man.
No, but he's naked.
As a sword.
Yeah, but you see, this is important. You said child. He ain't a child. He's a naked man.
He's covering her mantle. Is going to cover.
Yeah, but women can embrace a naked man. It doesn't have to be a child. Sometimes women
well,
are not always.
See,
that's a projection. See, it's a man.
But a babe.
Not a babe, a man.
Someone who's
a phallic. No, a phallic, a mature man. He's vulnerable.
Manly man, yes, he is.
He's got a phallus. He's capable of being vulnerable, but he's still phallic. He's fertilizing. He's desirable. This is not about childhood. This is about adult relationship between men and women.
I think that's a male point of view, but to me, you know, a strong feminine. I feel like she's going to make him.
But see, I think you're imposing. But you're imposing. We get naked when we have sex, not just when we're babies.
Well, she's going to show him what to do.
But that's the point. You see, adult life includes nakedness, and it's a part of relationship. So if you impose baby on this, you're really shortchanging the woman. She's worked very hard not to get a baby. She's worked hard to get a man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's not going to have burning lead. He's not going to have a hot iron.
No, he's all of that. All of that is being integrated.
I think we should go around the room and see who was best bed and who wasn't. That will lend lots of interpretation.
We don't have time, sorry.
We just do a show.
That was a rhetorical.
I mean, it's...
In retrospect, I think that this student was making an important point. It does say in the verse that Tamlin will be naked like a babe. And in a sense, Janet has given birth to Tamlin, you know, by holding him as he went through all these transformations. It's a little bit like the agony and the ecstasy of childbirth, I suppose. And indeed, he is wrapped naked in a mantle as though he were a baby. So there's a lot of ambiguity here. Clearly, Janet is getting herself a man, a hot-blooded man. But at the same time, there's imagery from childbirth. And I think this conveys the ambiguity of what's going on. After all, the vagina is both for sex and for childbirth. And what's going on here is the birth of consciousness. So it's the ambiguity. I think it's the ambiguity of the role of the feminine. The feminine is both Aphrodite and also the Great Mother, and Janet is both finding herself a man and giving birth to the new life. So the feminine plays a very ambiguous role, a very complex role in the creation of this new masculine form. And I think the student was making that point. I didn't recognize it at the time.
In a way, it's a good ending. I mean, she's a bit of... She goes on this quest and comes out with
a naked knight.
Absolutely. Whom she has embraced and transformed. She has her husband, and he's a full-blooded male force.
I'm just intrigued by one point here is that, I mean, I understand the fairy queen that she's upset about this to happen, right? He has a woman and is leaving her. She was given to give her son to hell. She was going to deliver, to send his son to hell before. So that, why is that? What does it mean?
That's a good question. Yeah, what would it mean if the knight had gone to hell instead of come back into the land of humans in Janet's embrace? What would it mean to go to hell?
Hell is the unconscious even more.
So what would that be?
Well, you get someone like Hitler, right? This force of nature that's Mars, like Aries. You get some ruthless, undifferentiated, natural
maybe.
Force.
Yeah, what were you going to say?
He would stay in the underworld.
Stay in the underworld, yeah. What would that be psychologically?
The unconscious.
Unconscious, so where would it, where do we encounter this, for example? Crazy, yeah. People who are locked in psychosis, that's a kind of hell, right, from which there might never be an escape. So he was a conscious knight, he fell into the unconscious, and he found his way out again, thereby enriching consciousness with the phallic power from the unconscious. But supposing he had never found his way out, supposing he had lost all touch with consciousness and gone even deeper, then he might have fallen into madness. So that's an example.
Illustration.
Yeah.
Why 7 years? What's this 7 years?
Saturn's where? So it's consciousness. Never, when you're seven, you become initially conscious, 14 and a half. You have the arc of separation from your parent, you go to be apprentice. 22 years you're out in the world, 29 years. You have the return of Saturn to the point of birth. So it's, you see it a lot in mortgages, relationships, marriages ending at those points.
Yeah.
It's the test of time.
Interesting. And
and
there's 7 days in the week. So
the
seven is a... Mm-hmm. Seven is a...
It's kind of like the test of
seven
time.
Planets.
Seven.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just want
to emphasize what you said. This is a very positive story of feminine development, because the woman initiates the action, takes charge, fights for what she wants, defies her father, defies the green man to some extent, works with the green man, conquers the fairy queen, and gets what she wants, right? A fertile relationship with a powerful. So it's a story of feminine development and individuation, which has a really full-blooded positive outcome.
Yeah, and the mother-in-law who didn't want her daughter married. Yeah, I know this. I know about this.
I felt the negative of that the fairy queen got this knight from the mortal world, and she was going to have her way with him. But then after 7 years, she was going to discard him to the fires of hell.
Yeah.
So it was the negative femininity in there.
Yeah.
This is a really important point that's being made here that I missed at the time. Yes, the story also portrays the negative aspect of the feminine, the devouring, destructive feminine, who had the initial relationship with Tamlin and would have sent him to hell if he had not escaped from it. So the story shows both sides and the combat between them. And the positiveness of his encounter with Janet is counterbalanced very nicely by the destructiveness of his encounter with the Fairy Queen. Very important point.
But in terms of, if you look at stories of feminine development, the outcome tends to be better the more passionate and assertive the feminine figure. In some fairy stories, the feminine figure is passive and gets carried along by the action and doesn't assert herself, and those stories often don't end very well for the feminine. But when the feminine, and I'm thinking of a couple of Eskimo tales in particular when I say this.
Inuit girls, Edna.
Yeah. When the feminine is really assertive and powerful, then the story tends to unfold in a more positive way, humanly positive way, for the women. And this is a case in point because Janet is so passionate and so assertive. So it's kind of nice girls finish last, so to speak.
The assertiveness is purely feminine, or is there a masculine? I mean, she's very efficient. Like, she seems to have attributes also that are masculine in the way that she holds it. I mean, she does exactly what she's supposed to do. And she's not afraid.
She's empowered by her father. So she's empowered. She's beginning to integrate the masculine all the way at every stage. Yeah, so she... Her assertiveness is both feminine and masculine, and she integrates. And as time goes on, more and more of the masculine is integrated as she holds this figure, and he transforms. So it's about the integration of masculine and feminine within the personality in a more and more productive and vital form.
It would be a very different story if the masculine was trying to integrate the feminine. The fairy tale would be a much different.
It'd have to be a different kind of story, yeah. Yeah. Well, we got to stop for today, but thank you for your lovely comments.
This is the end of part two. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this class, and I hope you'll listen to other classes on this website.